Greetings and pacifications, excellent listeners, and welcome to this March 2012 Science News Update. Resistance is futile, for I am your host for this newest of the new science podcasts, Jim Campanella. As I sit here contemplating tonight's episode, I get a weird, deja vu-ish kind of feeling. You may feel the same when you hear the first couple of stories. You will swear that you heard these stories previously, and you may have, kind of. It seems that some of these stories simply will not go away and continually need updates. Well, the first story, having to do with exoplanets, is one of those. It seems that for the third month in a row, interesting stuff is going on with exoplanets. What kind of interesting stuff? Well, let me tell you. Astronomers have finally found a water world. Well, kind of a water world. I don't think it's anything that Kevin Costner, our present terrestrial expert on water worlds, would get excited about. And yet, at the same time, this new exoplanet does have water. Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger, an astronomer at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg, and her collaborators published a paper this month in the Astrophysical Journal. The paper reports the finding of the first water world. This planet is not like all the others found to this point. It is also not quite new. It was actually originally discovered back in 2009, and it's only new studies of it that have yielded interesting results. GJ1214b has been shown to be a steamy, water-rich sphere, but it does not have oceans of water as we do here. Kaltenegger and company suspect that the planet's interior is filled with some exotic, high-pressure form of solid water, unlike anything seen on Earth. The planet is just 6.5 times more massive than Earth, falling into the super-Earth category, and about 2.7 times bigger in diameter. It circles a small star, which is fairly close, at about 42 light-years away from Earth. Using the Hubble telescope, Kaltenegger examined the planet as it passed in front of its star. Her team could study its atmosphere at a range of infrared wavelengths, and from there could estimate the planet's composition, which has been a mystery because of its low density. They have concluded that the atmosphere is at least half water and is probably crowded near the planet's surface. Apparently, the water is under such high pressure that it is not water as we know it. The paper says, quote, "The interior is probably largely water molecules instead of primarily rock, but it is not water in familiar frozen or liquid forms. The water is probably in one of the more strange forms of matter more akin to plasmid or a supersolid," unquote. I'm not even sure where the supersolid is, frankly. Well, we seem to be getting closer to finding a new Earth on almost a monthly basis now. Let's see what next month brings. In the meantime, you remember last month I discussed the oldest living clonal organism on the planet. That was a Mediterranean seagrass, which has been alive on Earth in its present form anywhere between the last 15,000 and 100,000 years. Well, tonight I present you with another oldest living plant which is not clonal. In this month's proceedings in the National Academy, the just recently deceased Dr. David Gilichinsky and his team from the Russian Academy of Sciences reported growth of the oldest plant tissue ever discovered and regeneration of those ancient plants. The ancient frozen tissue that was employed for this work was radiocarbon dated at about 31,800 years old. Take that, seagrass. Gilichinsky found a fruit cache in Siberia in the permafrost. It was stuffed into a burrow by a squirrel, and possibly one that looked like Scrat, that long-toothed rodent from the animated Ice Age movies. Wind-blown silt plugged the entrance to the squirrel's storage chamber 38 meters underground. The burrow froze and remained frozen, keeping its content dry, until the scientists excavated it. Tissue was scraped from the fruit and bathed in nutrients and grown into fertile plants with healthy seeds that eventually sprouted in soil. Now, let me clarify that last point. When I first saw this article, I thought that the researchers had simply isolated prehistoric seeds from the fruits and allowed them to germinate, but that was not the case. The scientists took the frozen tissues and regenerated them in tissue culture in a petri dish. This can be easily done with freshly picked plants. Plants can be grown in tissue culture in an undifferentiated state called a callus culture. After getting this ancient tissue to grow, Gilichinsky then manipulated the tissue-cultured cells of the newly grown ancient organism by treatment of specific plant hormones to induce the growth of leaves and shoots and roots. We cannot do this quite so easily yet with animal tissues, but you can induce higher plants to grow into any tissue you want using two hormones called auxin and cytokinin in specific ratios. The plant has tentatively been identified as being the same as the extant species Silena stenophylla, because it looks exactly like its modern relative. The common name for the Silena is the narrow-leafed campion, and that's a plant which grows in the far north even today. There has been some controversy as to whether this regenerated ancient plant actually is narrow-leafed campion or not. Some botanical experts have pointed out that the flowers, when they finally appeared, were narrower and less separated than those of today's representatives of the species. Some scientists have suggested that the recovered plant is no doubt campion, but it's a different but close relative of the narrow-leaved campion. The paper concludes with, quote, "It is remarkable that under deep freeze, fruit tissues can remain viable for such a long time. This is like regenerating a dinosaur from tissues of an ancient egg." Unquote. I guess that turning up my nose at bird's-eye frozen peas that have been in my big freezer stored for more than a year will now have to be a thing of the past. Certainly, if we can revive 30,000-year-old frozen plants that were around with the woolly mammoths, year-old frozen peas must still be edible. The next story up is again another deja vu moment reminding us of February. This update involves DNA sequencing and its increasing cheapness. Another company has thrown its hat into the ring, saying that they have the latest technology that will be the breakthrough in DNA sequencing that will lead the next technological generation. 2 weeks ago, at the Advances in Genome Biology and Technology meeting in Florida, the company Oxford Nanopore Technologies unveiled two new DNA sequencing systems, a high-throughput system called GridION, and a smaller, cheaper, and portable system called MiniION, which is the size of a portable computer hard drive. The company announced that both products will be available later this year. The systems rely on nanopore sequencing. Nanopore sequencing is a method for reading long, unbroken strands of DNA and RNA. A special proprietary enzyme pulls the nucleic acid strands through specially engineered nanopores, these are little tiny holes, in a polymer membrane. Meanwhile, as the DNA or RNA is being pulled through, an electronic chip senses disruptions in electrical current as uniquely identifiable combinations of nucleotide bases as each passes through the nanopore. At the meeting, company representatives presented data that demonstrated that the 48,000 base pair genome of the lambda bacteriophage virus could be sequenced as one long sequence. The nanopore chips process DNA at a rate of about 20 to 400 bases per second per pore. That is significantly faster than current sequencing systems, or for that matter, even the systems I mentioned last month. The reason it's so much faster is that you can actually sequence a whole series of strands, hundreds, maybe even thousands of strands in parallel. Parallel sequencing gives you immense power. Unfortunately, the system does have a high rate of error of about 4%. Before the products are officially launched by the company, Oxford Nanopore says that they aim to trim that error rate down to anywhere between a tenth of a percent to less than 2% by developing better, more efficient nanopores. The GridION nodes contain a consumable cartridge with about 2,000 nanopores on them, capable of processing tens of gigabases of sequence data in a 24-hour period. Remember that a single read of the human genome is about 3 gigabases, so we're talking up to tenfold coverage in 24 hours for a genome, which is almost unimaginable. The portable and disposable MiniION will feature 500 nanopores and cost less than $900. Given that the other systems that we've discussed are hundreds, thousands of dollars in cost, that again is simply astounding. While the company has not priced the full-size GridION unit yet, it expects that the cost per genome sequenced will be competitive with other systems. If the company is able to keep the price down to several thousand dollars per unit, it will bring about an even greater revolution than I have predicted previously. Such affordable technology could transform diagnostic medicine. Imagine not just sequencing somebody's genome. If they are ill with an infection, imagine being able to scan patients using this cheap sequencing technology and immediately seeing what viruses or bacteria that they are infected with. It could completely change the world of medicine. At the conference, the reps for Oxford Nanopore said that by 2013, they hope to sequence an entire human genome in just 15 minutes. They said that it will require 20 of their GridION units running in parallel, equipped with 8,000 nanopores each. But they insist that it can be done. Having cut my teeth on the old-fashioned system of sequencing, I cannot even imagine that speed. Given such a system as Oxford describes, you could sequence 96 human genomes a day. Welcome to the future, ladies and gents. It has arrived with bells on. Speaking of the future being here, there is a report out of February's annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver that will blow some of you away. For years, a slew of SF writers, including Robert Heinlein, Andrea Norton, H. Beam Piper, Philip K. Dick, Frank Herbert, William Gibson, etc., etc., have predicted a future in which we will have, quote-unquote, vat-grown meat, and we will no longer be dependent on growing livestock for food. Dr. Mark Post of Maastricht University in the Netherlands reported at the meeting that hamburger made from meat grown in the laboratory may be ready to eat by the end of this year. So far, Post and his team have been using bovine stem cells to regenerate pieces of skeletal muscle that are anywhere between 3 and 5 centimeters in length. Those tissues seem to be healthy and sterile and edible. In his presentation, Post cited a growing global demand for meat and the massive environmental costs of raising livestock. He said, quote, "We need to get alternatives," unquote. Post seems to think that with adequate funding, lab-grown meat products may be commercially available in grocery stores near you in the next 10 years. The next story is completely unrelated to anything we have discussed previously in this podcast. In fact, the next story is so completely out there that I have never even considered the possibility of what I'm about to tell you. For a moment, let's talk about the concept of a crystal. We all kind of know what a crystal is. We know that salt is a crystal of sodium chloride and that diamonds are crystals of carbon. But what is a crystal? And why is there a difference between a diamond and a chunk of coal, which are both made of the exact same thing? Well, a crystal is a substance in which all the molecules are aligned into a regular repeating three-dimensional matrix. Most substances have molecules higgledy-piggledy all over the place in three-dimensional space, with no regularity in their structure. Crystals are tougher materials because of this three-dimensional matrix. Diamonds, for example, are carbon crystals where the carbon has been forced into a close repeating matrix by very high heat and pressure. That makes it far stronger than any piece of coal. Okay, so now we know what a physical crystal is in nature. Now I'm going to tell you something that will probably remind you of an episode of the old Saturday morning TV show, The Land of the Lost. And I do not mean the crappy movie with Will Ferrell. For those of you who do not know The Land of the Lost, it was a TV show back in the 1970s, in which two kids and their dad got trapped inside a closed universe where dinosaurs, lizard people called Sleestaks, and other aliens could be found. The show was essentially about how the Marshall family could survive such an alien environment and even eventually escape. One of the aliens, written in an episode by Star Trek's Walter Koenig, by the way, was an Eltrusian lizard man called Enoch, who carried advanced technology with him. One of the artifacts that Enoch carried with him was a glowing crystalline lozenge called a Mageti, a fourth-dimensional node, as he calls it, which allowed one to travel in space and time. It was, in short, a time crystal. Well, as a kid, I thought that was very, very cool, and I was fascinated with that entire theme that The Land of the Lost kept up for a couple of seasons, of the crystals having such abilities. Well, apparently I was not the only one enthralled with the Land of the Lost. Time crystals could actually become the next big thing in theoretical physics. In a new article this month on the science website archive.org, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Frank Wilczek lays out the mathematics of how an object moving in its lowest energy state could experience a sort of structure in time that is similar to a time crystal. Wilczek describes how such a time crystal would be the temporal equivalent of an everyday 3D physical crystal like a diamond. No one knows how important time crystals may turn out to be or whether they even have any practical applications at all. But Wilczek says, quote, "This concept of a time crystal reminds me of the excitement I felt when I helped describe a new class of fundamental particles called anions back in the early 1980s. I had very much the same kind of feeling as I'm having here that I have found a new logical possibility for how matter might behave that opens up a new world with many possible directions." Unquote. Wilczek came up with time crystals after teaching a class about classifying crystals in three dimensions and wonders why that structure couldn't extend into a fourth dimension, that is, time. To visualize a time crystal, think of Earth looping back to its same location in space every 365 days. The planet repeats itself periodically as it moves through time, like a crystal does in three dimensions. But a true time crystal would not be a planet, but an object in its lowest energy state, like an electron stripped of all possible energy. Wilczek says that this object could endlessly loop in time, just as electrons in a superconductor could theoretically flow through space for all eternity. In one sense, a time crystal would be a perpetual motion machine. That is, if scientists could build one in a lab, it would run forever. And it wouldn't violate the second law of thermodynamics because the crystal would be in its lowest energy state, and you couldn't actually get any energy extracted from it. As if time crystals are not weird enough, Wilczek wants to extend the concept into imaginary time, a theoretical concept of the fourth dimension that runs in a different direction than the one people experience. I won't even try to understand that one. All I know about imaginary time is that it involves what you plan on getting done on a Saturday morning until real life starts to interfere. The last story of the night involves alcohol. I suspect that many famous authors, including Raymond Chandler, James Joyce, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Dylan Thomas, William Faulkner, Edgar Allan Poe, and Hunter S. Thompson would just laugh at the next story and simply say, duh, although I suspect they would probably say that in a much more literary manner. So what is this alcoholic story? In the journal Consciousness and Cognition, an article that was published at the end of January by Dr. Jennifer Wiley and colleagues at the University of Illinois, suggests that, quote, "A composer or artist may indeed find creative benefits from intoxication," unquote. Yes, Dr. Wiley and company have found evidence that drinking alcohol may start creative juices flowing and help you to solve creative problems. Research subjects who drank themselves tipsy solved more problems demanding verbal resourcefulness in less time than sober volunteers did. In the study, 20 social drinkers watched an animated movie. The volunteers then drank enough of a vodka cranberry drink to reach an average peak alcohol blood level of 0.075%. That is just below the current 0.08% cutoff for legal intoxication in the U.S. Another 20 social drinkers watched the same movie without drinking. Volunteers in both groups then completed a creative problem-solving task. For each of 15 items, subjects saw three words. For example, moon, flash, and spot. And they had to think of a fourth word that would form a phrase with each of those first words, such as light. Moonlight, flashlight, spotlight. On average, participants at peak intoxication solved about 9 problems correctly, versus approximately 6 winners for the sober group. It took an average of about 11.5 seconds for intoxicated participants to generate a correct solution, compared to 15.2 seconds for sober volunteers. Both groups performed comparably on the test before the study began. There are a couple of hypotheses why we may be seeing this inebriation effect. The paper suggests that intoxication may aid verbal creativity. partly by lowering the ability to control one's thoughts. It also may be that intoxicated individuals become less afraid to make mistakes in their tasks after drinking. That could be another possible creativity booster. And I have to admit personally, if I was not deathly afraid of becoming dependent on alcohol as part of the actual process of writing, I would try it. I have noticed that in social drinking situations, my verbal output in conversation does go up, and that I often have insights while thinking aloud that I may not have had otherwise. When I was a student working on my doctorate, I remember many a pleasant Friday afternoon at the unofficial end of the work week, when my very British thesis advisor would have a lab meeting in his office, which included a very large bottle of wine that had been chilling there in his fridge all day. My fellow students and postdocs used that time to loosen up and discuss our experiments from the week. Those meetings almost always resulted in a better understanding of what we were observing. I'm not sure that would have been the case under completely sober conditions. However, it just seems to me that you have to be very careful once that magic genie has been let out of the bottle. It's far too easy to get to the point where the magic no longer works, no matter how much more alcohol you imbibe. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. If you plan on writing and imbibing at the same time, then do so in a most careful manner. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.